bought or sold. Sex buyers or johns drive the illegal sex trade. Without their money, pimps and human traffickers have zero incentives. No buyers means no business. You can learn how to turn your concern to action at demandabolition.org. You're listening to 90.1 KPFT Houston, kpft.org online.
Well, Maxine, I guess Zoom is not a bad thing, because here we are seeing each other for the first time since you moved to Washington State, right? And as I was saying, I think we'd recognize each other. That's the main thing. Kind of strange. Have you done a lot of stuff with Zoom?
Recently a lot of our work has been online, so I'm familiar with it.
How do you feel about sitting there and looking at people in their homes and, you know, checking out all that they've got?
I don't mind doing that so much. I think the most off-putting part is seeing yourself, because as tellers, we're not used to seeing our expressions or what we're doing. So it's like shutting out another thing. It's okay to look at the audience, because it's fun to look at the audience. But when you see yourself, it's not such a good thing.
It's a whole new world. Well, you know, it was June 3rd, 2013, when you were my debut guest on the weekly version of So What's Your Story? Talk about a long time ago. And at that time, you told stories about the life cycle, Irish style, which I thought was really appropriate for a first show. And tonight, you've got a few tales about transformation, because October 31st, which of course is today, happy Halloween, through tomorrow is the Celtic New Year, Samhain, which of course, as you know, I had to learn to pronounce phonetically. People probably think I really know how to pronounce that. I don't. I spent the last 9 hours learning it. But it is an important time. It's when the veil between this world and the world of the dead is at its thinnest, right? You know, now, since we're recording this today on Halloween, tell us how Samhain connects to Halloween.
Well, the first thing I'll say to you is I'll actually greet you in Gaelic to say happy Halloween, which is Iahana Hana Grief. So Iahana Hana Grief, Hank. Happy Halloween. Here we are at Samhain. Samhain for us is the Celtic New Year. It's extremely important because it's the end of summer. The harvest is in. The warriors have all been sent out to the various families to take care of them in the darkness, because in the darkness we couldn't fight in those days. So the warriors were sent off to various clans. And Samhain really and truthfully celebrates for us the long and the dark cold nights. And it's the time for festivals, because what a better time to do it than at that time. Right. The fields are also turned over to the others, and the others are the she, our fae, as well as the dead walking on the 31st and coming to greet us. We also have the veil thin for the others to come through and speak with us too, and play with us and do all sorts of things. They can do it all year round, but particularly so on the 31st. So we have spirits and fae everywhere around us.
And the operative word here, you know, listening to that description, I hadn't heard that description until just now, but my guess was that transformation really is that common denominator.
And yes, that's very true. It is. It's the common denominator, because the fae also teach us lessons as much as the dead do. And the stories I'll tell today kind of are a mixture of both. But I will say some of the traditions we have translated across to America. In fact, Halloween is actually All Hallows Eve, which is the night before All Saints Day. And so it becomes Halloween. And that's why it's called what it is. And for us, it just meshed in with our tradition, our pagan festival of Samhain. So why it's so important.
Let's start with your first story. And I guess it's significant that this is the first story, I think. And it's entitled Cormac MacArt and the Magic Branch.
That's correct. Cormac MacArt was considered to be one of our finest high kings of Ireland. And he lived on Tara, which is the centre of the royal place for the high kings in Ireland. And the story goes that one day Cormac came out of his fort, and he stood on the hill and he looked across the fields of Ireland. And all he could hear was the music, and he could hear the wheels of the water wheels going round and round, and the spinning wheels, and all was quiet. There was no war. he was a very contented king in one sense. I mean, he did have a beautiful wife. He had a lovely son and daughter, and he also had a very beautiful mistress who sang him to sleep at night. So he had little to complain of. But for some reason, Cormac was discontent. So he stood there and he looked across, and all of a sudden he heard the most beautiful music that he'd ever heard in his life. It was the sort of music that just touched your soul and brought your heart alive. And in the distance, he saw a young man walking towards him, and in his hand, he had a silver branch, and on the silver branch were three golden apples. And every time the young man shook this branch, this music grew and grew, and it took away all the thoughts in his head, all his discontentment. And he knew in his heart he had to have that silver branch. So he said to the young man, "What will you take for that silver branch?" And the young man said, "Well, I'll tell you what, Cormac Mac Art, High King of Ireland, what I will take is three wishes, and I will come for the first wish in a year's time." And the king said, "Well, where is it you're from?" And he said, "Well, I come from the Isle of Apples, the Plain of Truth, but I will be back in a year, and I will then give you my first wish and ask for it." So Cormac thanked him and took the branch, and all the people of Ireland and everyone was content. No one grieved anymore. No one was unhappy anymore, for all Cormac had to do was shake the branch. A year later, the man comes back. Cormac's waiting for him. And he says, "I'm here to grant your wish," says Cormac to the young man. "What do you want?" The young man says, "I want your daughter." And Cormac looked at him and said, "You want my daughter?" He said, "You can't have my daughter. I love my daughter as the pasture loves rain. You can't take my daughter." And the young man says, "That's the wish. That's what I want. Or give me back the branch." So Cormac hands over his daughter. And the young man walks away and disappears into a mist. And the whole of Ireland grieves, and his wife grieves, and he grieves. And then he shakes the branch and all grief is forgotten. A year goes by. The young man turns up again. And this time Cormac says, "What's your wish?" He says, "I want your son." "Oh, you can't take my son. My son is like the sun on the sky to the field beneath it. You can't take my son." He says, "That's the wish. Or give me back the branch." And Cormac hands over his son. Year goes by. And this time Cormac's really afraid. And the young man stands before him and says, "Give me your wife." And Cormac loved his wife more than anything. And he said, "No, I cannot give you my wife, for I love her as the pasture loves the rain and the sun. I will give you horses. I will give you wealth. I will give you all that you want, but I cannot give you my wife." And the young man said, "Well, that's what I want, and that's what I'm taking." He says, "Well, take back the branch." And the young man said, "No, I'm taking your wife." And with that, he began to walk off into the mist. And Cormac called after him and said, "Family means everything to me. You cannot take them all. I will follow you. I will follow you to the ends of the earth. And I will either die fighting to get them back, or I will stay with them." So he follows the young man through the mist. Over hills, down dales they go. They go through bogs. They go through more mist, further and further south. And all the time, the young man and his wife is just ahead of him. And finally, he knows he's in the land of the Sidhe, the land of the fairy, because he sees all around him the most beautiful scenery. And in front of him, there's this silver fort. And the roof of the fort is covered and thatched in feathers. And sitting on a throne in the center is a beautiful woman who wears a crown of golden salmon with ruby eyes. And beneath her, sitting round her feet, is his son, his wife, and his daughter. And the young man is there. And she says, "Welcome, Cormac. Welcome to the land of Manannan Mac Léir, the king of the sea, the god of the sea. And I am Anya, goddess of Ireland." And Cormac looks and he sees the young man. He says to him, "Please take back the silver branch. Do anything. Let me stay here with my family, for I love them so much and I cannot be without them. I know now how important they are to me. And for you to take them, my heart is broken." And the young man says, "Well, Cormac, I am Manannan Mac Léir," and immediately becomes an old man with a long white beard, a fine muscular old man, but still an old man. The god of the sea stands before him, upon his head a silver crown of horses with sapphire eyes. And he says, "I tell you what, Cormac, you are a good king, but you have been brought here to realize what is important to you and to have better judgment in your old age. Now that you have learned that lesson, I will give you the gift of the silver branch. And I will also give you the gift of the cup of truth. Three lies told above this cup will break it. One truth will mend it. So you will be the wisest of all kings. So that night they remain and they feast and they hear poets and storytellers. And the next morning, Cormac and his family wake up on the sides and the slopes of Tara. Beside him, the silver branch. On the other side of him, the cup of truth. And it is said of Cormac, he is our finest of high kings. And to this day, the very cattle sigh when they lie down in the fields, when they remember the days of Cormac MacArt.
Beautiful. That is so beautiful. I'm trying to remember if I heard that story before. But I do want listeners to know that when you make reference to the land of she, you are talking about the land of fairies, because I know that
I'm talking the land of the others. Yeah. I mean, I can tell you very quickly a couple of things about the spirits that tend to walk at this time of Samhain. I mean, Cormac MacArt to me is a very special story, and you would have heard it probably in the Path of Tea when I've told it a couple of times, because it's one of our finest and most beautiful in my mind stories, and speaks to us on many levels of what's important in life and the importance of and how we transform. When we lose something, we transform. Sometimes it takes us to lose it before we realize the importance.
Oh, that is so true. That is so true. Your next story, Tygo Kane, right? And the corpse. in this story, did I pronounce that correctly, Tyg?
It's Teague. Tygo Kane.
Teague. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I went to the wrong site. You know, you go to these sites and they tell you this is how you pronounce it.
Well, now I will say to you that the reason why you may pronounce it differently, because we have three dialects very strong in Gaelic in Ireland, which is Munster, Connacht and Ulster. So each of them tends to have a little bit of change. So you probably heard a different.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, Maxine, the only right dialect is your dialect. But in this story, death is a little bit more exposed. Death is a little bit more explicit, which is sort of interesting.
Yes, in this story, this is Tygo Kane and the corpse. Tygo Kane, he was the son of a very wealthy farmer, very handsome young man who said he carried the heart of many young women in the pocket, breast pocket of his shirt. But he was a bit of a gambler. He was a bit of he was a womanizer. He was many a thing. And his father loved him dearly and often gave in to him. Well, it came to the day whenever his father heard about a young woman of a neighbour who was shamed by Teague. And his father brought him to him and said to him, listen, boy, he said, I will disinherit you and give all my lands and everything to your cousin if you don't clean up your ways and marry Mary, our neighbour's daughter. Now, Teague listened to his father and thought he was just being a bit tough and didn't think much of it. But his father said, boy, you don't know, but I'm serious and I mean it. You clean up your act, you marry Mary, or it all goes to your cousin. So Teague walks out of the house and goes for a walk. Now, it's getting late at night, and it's not always safe to walk the roads of Ireland late at night because the she and the others will be about. But anyway, off he goes, and he's smoking his pipe, and he's turning it over in his head. And it's not that he doesn't think highly of Mary and that he'd marry her. It's just simply that he doesn't feel like he's quite ready for it, and he still has some playing in him. He still wants to go out there and gamble on the horses and have a good time with his friends. So he decides he'll tell his father that the next time he sees him. And he walks along the road, and suddenly he realizes he's far away from home. And surely to goodness, it must be after midnight. And sure enough, it is. At that the point, the moon goes behind a cloud. Suddenly he hears many, many feet tramping down the road towards him. And he doesn't understand what it is, so he hides in the hedgerow and he looks out. And in front of him are about 20 or 30 little men, and they're carrying something heavy on their shoulders. And Teague looks at it, and first he just hides there until they stop. And one of the little men calls out, Tygo Kane, are you there in the hedgerow? Come out. So he comes out and he stands there and he's very nervous. And suddenly they throw the package down onto the ground and it turns out to be a corpse. Now at that point, Teague definitely backs off into the hedgerow. And the little man says, Tygo Kane, pick up that corpse. And Teague looks at him and he can't say anything. He's frozen. And the little man says again, Tygo Kane, did you hear me? Pick up that corpse. Nothing is said. For the third time, the little man says, I'm going to ask you for the last time, Tygo Kane, pick up the corpse. And he doesn't do it. And the little man says to his other men, look at that. He wouldn't pick up the corpse. Pick him up for him. So they lift the corpse and they go towards Teague. He begins to run. They trip him up. They throw him down the ground. They put the corpse on his back. The arms of the corpse tighten around his neck. The legs of the corpse tighten around his hips and he can feel its breath on his neck. At that point, they get him on his feet and the little man says to him, now, Tygo Kane, you've been a bad lad. and we're going to teach you a lesson. Tonight you have to bury that corpse before sunrise. You're going to go, the first place you've got to go to is Temple Demas. If you can't bury it there, the next place you've got to go to is Carrigor Fadoris. If you can't bury it there, the next place you go to is Temple Ronan. If you can't bury it there, the next place you go to is Imbolc Fada. If you can't bury it there, and finally Kilbreegia, but you must do it before sunrise. So off he goes. They give him a kick in the backside and send him towards Temple Demas. He arrives at the church. It's locked. He can't get in. What does he do? He says, what am I to do? I can't find the key. And a voice in his ear says, look above the door. And it's the corpse that's talking to him. So he says, what? And the corpse says, don't have me. Repeat it again, boy. Look above the door and get the key and bury me. Bury me soon. So he gets the key, he opens the door and he takes him in. Places in darkness. Light a candle, boy. How am I to light a candle? I've got nothing. He's a rag in his pocket. He takes out a flint. He lights it. And then he sees an old candle lying on the ground. He picks it up, lights it, and the church, now in ruin, comes into bright light. There against the wall is an old spade. He picks it up. He lifts the first flagstone. He lifts the second one. He starts to dig down. Suddenly he hits a corpse, and the corpse sits up and says, hey, boy, what do you think you're doing? He says, why, don't bury him here. This is not his place. Get away out of here. It'll be the worst for you. Lies down back again. He covers him up. Flagstone's back on. Goes to the back of church. Tries again. This time an old woman sits up and says, what's this fool done that he's no grave of his own? She falls back. He has to bury her again. And they go out of the church. Teague sits down. What am I to do? I don't even know where Carrick Fadoris is. And the guy and the corpse lifts his hand and points in the direction to go. And off goes Teague with a corpse on his back. And finally they get to this place. And there's a low wall. But beyond it, what does he see? He sees ghosts galore, men, women, children, all screaming silently with their mouths open at him. Each step he takes, they scream more. He stops still. They go silent. So he knows the corpse can't be buried there. The corpse points the way to Temple Ronan. He makes his way to Temple Ronan. Nothing happens. There's no ghosts. There doesn't seem to be anybody about. He makes his way through the gate, and then a pair of invisible hands grab him and the corpse and fling him out. Where to next? Imbolc Fada, off he goes, the corpse on his back, all the way guiding him, that horrible breath against it, up his nose, that horrible sound in his ear. And finally, he arrives there. And Imbolc Fada is nothing but a little mound in the middle of a field. But as he approaches, a circle of fire starts to spin around and around this mound. It gets faster and faster. Sparks fly out of it. Lightning hits it. Well, he knows the corpse can't be buried there. On he goes to the next place, Kilbreegia. He arrives, and there is an open grave, and he knows this must be the place for the corpse. So gradually the corpse, he goes over to the grave, he looks in, and there's the coffin, and the corpse goes, bury me, the sun is rising, and suddenly you can see in the far distance, there is the sun. So desperately he jumps into the grave, he pulls off the coffin lid, sure enough it's empty, and the corpse slides from him and into the coffin. He nails up the coffin, jumps out, puts the soil in and runs to the nearest inn where he sleeps for 48 hours. He borrows a horse and gets home. When he gets there, there's celebration because the people thought he'd left the country. He tells his father what happened, but no one else. He marries his Mary, and for the rest of his days, he doesn't gamble, takes a drink only now and again, but never goes out in the roads after midnight.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. I love that, you know, Irish storytelling, or Irish storytellers, I should say, are very comfortable about telling tales about death as a part of life. And this last story, of course, is no exception. Because for me, as a listener, it makes life much more vivid. You know, the entire notion of transformation more vivid in a lot of American folktales. And for that matter, Western European folktales, death is very implicit. In other words, we don't want to talk about it. We really don't, you know, right? Yeah. I mean, we use a lot of metaphors to talk about death, but one of the things I always enjoy about Irish folktales is that death is really made very explicit, and we're going to get to some stories a little bit later that even make that more clear, like Bookbinder, for example, your story, mm-hmm. which is a child-friendly story about death. But it's a very difficult mm-hmm. thing to do. And, you know, I think it's important for listeners to understand that death is an integral part of life, obviously. And one of the things that we learned from this set of stories that we're essentially celebrating now, Samhain, is about transformation, but transformation really addresses life and death as inextricably related. And that's what these stories, I think, make so, so very, very clear.
Well, yeah, I think you're right there, because as the Irish, we always talk about carrying death on our hip, you know, it stays with us. Right. And I will say that one thing I will talk about as Samhain is that one of the people that goes out at this time of night is the Dullahan. The Dullahan's the dark man who they reckon used to be one of our ancient gods, Crumdove. And Crumdove was a god that demanded human sacrifice. And so people were decapitated. That's the way he liked his sacrifices in his name. Now, when Christianity came, that obviously was not allowed to continue. And he went into the background, but it's believed that Crumdove took on the physical appearance of Dullahan, who is a headless horseman, which links into a lot of your myths here in America about, you know, Samhain, Halloween night. And as a headless horseman, he would have in his hand the spine of a human was his whip for his black stallion, and he would carry his head above his neck so that he could see into the down into the darkness and into the distance. And he actually, unlike the banshee who warns of death, once he called your name, he pulled your soul out of your body. So the only way to protect yourself, and if you saw him coming, he could throw a bucket of blood onto you, or he could blind you in the left eye if you watched him. But if he didn't call your name, once he called your name, no gate, no door could keep him out. You had to go. Your soul was taken. But if you had a piece of gold and you put it in front of him, he couldn't go past gold, so he would have to leave. So we learned, if you're going out in the roads at night after midnight, take a bit of gold with you and be home before sunset if you can. And those were that was the Dullahan. And sometimes in a coach drawn by six black horses, which set fire to the hedgerows as he went by. So he's a very powerful image this time of year.
Very much so. Your next story, I'm excited about your next story. Your next story is one of my favorites. In fact, I remember asking you to tell it when you were a guest around Valentine's Day, because along with it being a very meaningful story about transformation, it's a charming love story. It's just a beautiful love story, right? I think it is. Yeah. Loose in the Swan. And it's from your Wee Tale booklets, which we're going to talk about in just a few minutes. But tell us the story.
There once was an old gray goose that lived on a pond in the middle of Ireland. And the love of his life was a beautiful swan. And the goose knew that there was no way he'd ever be with this swan, for swans mate for life. And she had a partner. And every spring he waited for her to return. Well, this spring the shadows in the pond were getting longer and longer, and she hadn't returned. And he grew more and more concerned. And then one day he saw her, but he couldn't see her mate. And then he saw her mate coming very slowly behind her, and he knew something was terribly wrong. The two swans landed in the pond, and he could see that the male swan was injured. He watched as the female swan put her neck under her lover's neck and lifted it out of the water so he could feed, and also to keep him from drowning. And the old grey goose went over to help, to give her a break, and he would take the swan's neck in under his and hold it up while she ate and rested. For 3 days and three nights they did this, until it came time for the swan's mate to die. With that last breath, he made his way to the end of the pond. He stretched out his beautiful neck and he died. And she, for the first time, now the old goose knew that she would leave in the fall, and he dreaded the thought of it. But together they swam around the pond all summer, and fall came and the swan did not leave. And she remained with the old grey goose for three springs, three falls, three summers, three winters. But he was old, and it came for his time to leave. And as he lay on the side of the pond, and he opened his eyes and he looked at her for the last time, and then he shut them and passed away. She sang for the second time in her life her swan song for the old grey goose. And then she lifted out of the water. The sprinkles of the water fell back down in spirals into the pond. She lifted her beautiful neck. She lifted her beautiful wings and followed the sun as it set and headed west.
God, I love that story. Well, I do. I love that story. I'm looking for a Kleenex right now. It's a good thing I have it hanging at me. It's just a beautiful story. It's a gorgeous story. And the first time I heard that story was during one of your mini concerts, as I call it, at Path of Tea, a great place in town, which deserves a real shout out for supporting storytellers, well, you in particular. And I remember listening to that story, and I thought to myself, because you were going to be on the show a couple weeks later, and I said, boy, oh boy, if I do not forget to myself to have her tell that story. It's one of the most beautiful stories you tell, because it's all encompassing. It's all encompassing. You know, that story to me, and I use that in class, by the way, I should tell you this. And I want you to know, and obviously I give myself credit, but they don't believe me. So then I have to give you credit. Yeah, for writing the story. But no, the reason I do that is because I talk about the fact that fables and folktales are really powerful because we use animals to personify the human condition, right? And sometimes with certain emotions, and love is one of them, It isn't easy. It encompasses loneliness and loss and grieving. And I'm not saying something you don't already know, but it's often very difficult to comprehend love as complex as it is in stories that frankly just deal with people. You have to listen to animals that are softer and move.
I think for a lot of people, it's easier to talk about something outside of yourself whenever then you can feel it for yourself. I mean, I watch this often when I'm storytelling because, as I said, the stories are so ancient I tell. They really tell themselves, and I disappear as the storyteller. And I watch the audience at times, and I can see the different effects on their faces. And sometimes even if somebody just simply falls asleep, that's fine. Because they're traveling, they're journeying. And I think that's the beauty of fiction, and is the beauty of being able to, because in another's feelings, we understand our own. In another's feelings, we walk alongside and we become part of that, and we accept them and thereby accept ourselves. That's the strength and importance of stories in my mind.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I also just want to point out that some people think about traditional stories and personal stories as so separate. You know, you are a traditional storyteller. I am more of a personal storyteller. So why is it that we love each other's stories? Well, it's the same reason that stories connect, because stories connect. It doesn't make any difference what the genre is. There's something about it that just works. This is Hank Rubicek with my friend and guest storyteller, Maxine Lennon, on So What's Your Story? Only on Pacifica KPFT Houston and 91.9 for our friends in Huntsville. Maxine, you remember the eclectic group from the Houston Storytellers Guild? That was a rather interesting group, right?
I do, yes.
Yeah. We had
a lot of
about them. If they're listening right now, I want them to know. We didn't talk bad about you guys. We just talked about you guys. right. On the way there and back. It was just fun. Yeah. Okay. But in any event, the Guild is around, and the Guild is our sponsor and has done its share of transforming itself, others, into the world of storytelling, because even during a pandemic, we've had a lot of folks from all over the country, as a matter of fact, zooming in and having a ball. They meet the fourth Tuesday of every month. The next story swap is Tuesday, November 24th from 7 to 8:30 p.m. Central Time. Please visit the Guild's website at www.houstonstorytellers.org for the link and for more information about all of our upcoming events. And while you're on the site, please enjoy our past So What's Your Story programs, all of them since 2008 when I was 15 years old. Several will have Maxine's name listed as a guest. Check them all out under the category radio program. It would be really nice to have a radio, but you don't need one when tuning in every week to our award-winning program, because you can listen to us stream live on kpft.org. Get to know us by visiting our So What's Your Story Facebook page, and please be sure to share it with our friends, and we would love it if you'd like us when you leave. If you have a program idea, maybe suggestions for a guest teller, maybe even yourself, please let us know by dropping us a note at story@kpft.org, and we promise to get back to you. Our friends at the Moth may not be packing in a warehouse live, but you can catch them online, including nationwide story slams that you're going to love. And for anyone wanting to take their storytelling skills to the next level, why not become a member of Tejas Storytelling Association and the National Storytelling Network? And one final word before we get back to the stories. It is the end of our fall drive, and as always, our team thanks you and your donations for endorsing So What's Your Story as Houston's on-air storytelling platform. We're the original, we're the first, and we're around. And I want to give a special shout out to our friend and frequent guest and occasional co-host, Paul Topekian, for his unrelenting generosity and loyalty, and to our show and my personal gratitude to this gracious community for always, always having a story to tell. Maxine, this is a tough question, but why is it that you think radio work, that storytelling works so well on radio? I know we've talked about it a little bit, but what makes radio and storytelling such good friends?
I think because, to be honest with you, it focuses on the words. Sometimes it's the voice. I mean, I'm a very traditional storyteller in the sense that, as my grandmother would say to you, let it fall out of your mouth, whatever way it falls. And it's not about performance. It's not about getting up in clothes and drama. It's simply about the power of the words. And I think that if you're fed visions all the time, as television is, it doesn't give you a chance to really just let your own mind take you to where you want to go with the story. It's like being in private and reading your book. It's the same thing. So I think that for me, it's the words that matter. It's not the visions. I can't draw you a picture. I can't do you a video, but you can hear the words and you get that chance to travel. That's why I tell to adults and not to children. You know, I do that. Because I want them to travel. I want them to lose this time.
Right. No, that is so well articulated. The other day in my class, you know, I'm retired, but I'm still doing a couple of classes. One is storytelling. I played for them. It was from the Smithsonian collection, some old Edgar Allan Poe stories that were told on the radio in 1947. Okay. And I started to play one. I played The Telltale Heart, which is always my favorite. I had that on the radio show a couple of weeks ago, but I started to play it, and purposely, after about a minute, I turned it off and I said, okay, so that's what a story sounded like on radio. And this is on Zoom, and about a dozen raised their hand. Wait a minute. I want to hear the whole thing. And of course, I was hoping they would do that, and I asked them why. And this is the honest to God truth. One student said, well, I was just closing my eyes and imagining the picture. I mean, I couldn't have said it better myself. And that's exactly what you're talking about. It's about really embracing the words and painting that verbal picture in your mind. And I'm so proud of being able to do that with this kind of a program, because I think that's exactly what we do, very, very do. How do you go about captivating an audience? I know that sounds a little bit strange. I'm always interested in how storytellers go about captivating an audience. Now, I know why you captivate me, but I'm interested in your point of view.
Well, I think, as I said, for me, it's like, I think it's the magic of the stories themselves that do it. It's not so much me. And also, I have a way of beginning storytelling where I always say the power is in the words. Words are magic. With words, we fall in love, and with words, we send our children to war. Words are powerful. And I think that grasps people when they hear something like that. It's almost like, as we call it in Ireland, a glamour, a spell. You're casting a spell. There's a glamour, and people focus in on that, and they suddenly realize the importance of words, which we as a people don't realize what a miracle words are, that we can form our thoughts and our visions and everything that we are into a sentence, into words, and say it. It's an incredible thing, gift that we have.
But don't underestimate your own skill in offering that. I mean, I know what you're saying, but you know, you're incredibly modest. You really are. You're awfully modest. And you've always been that way. You've always been, ever since I've known you, you've always been very modest, saying, well, you know, I'm not saying that I do that or I do this, but you give a lot of credit to words. And I think that's great. But without people like you, the words don't mean anything. There are a bunch of arbitrary letters which don't mean anything until you, the human communicator, the storyteller, does something with them. You have a great sense of meaning of words. But let me tell you why I find you so captivating. First of all, your stories are, let me tell you, I have an answer for you. Not that you asked, but I'm going to give you one anyway. They're captivating because you have a way of entering into a story without me knowing you're entering into a story. You have a way of just entering into a story, and that story becomes an integral part of your conversational skill set. In other words, when you converse, it's in story form. The only other person I knew who did that well was my grandmother. And, because she kept me there. If I asked her a question like, what's for dinner? She'd tell me a story about a little boy who went to the carnival. You remember that one? I'd have to sit there for a half hour figuring out what she meant. And then I figured out, you don't want me to ask me that again. But it took a story to get me there. You do that. You enter a story effortlessly, seamlessly. And most people don't do that. They can't do that. And that's why I think, you're so excellent at what we do. Now, up next, up next is Vicious Fairies, which is, in my mind, sort of a literary oxymoron, like Glenda, the Good Witch of the North, right? Let's hear this one.
Yeah. This one, first of all, thank you very much. I take a high compliment that you mentioned your grandmother and me in the same sentence. That's very humbling for me. But anyway, the Vicious Fairies. This one involves a priest. There was an old priest who was reckoned to be a very good priest. He was a very lovely priest in the fact that no matter what time of day or night it was, if the door knocked and his parishioners needed him, especially if they were dying, if someone in the family was dying, the priest would go, he would be there. Now, as we all know, some people take an awful long time to go. One man in particular was thought to be going for 6 months on a trot. And so every time the priest would go, but every time the old fellow would get up again and be fine again after the confession was given and the last rites. So the door knocked at 2 o'clock, or closer to midnight than that one night. And again, there was the grandson saying that the grandfather was dying and would the priest please come? And of course, immediately the priest agreed. The curate, the younger priest, was not so sure. But the priest said, no, it's our duty, boy. You get up, you get the horse ready, you get the cart ready, and we're going. So off they went. Now, the old horse knew the way to this old man because, as I said, he'd done it several times over the last 6 months. And so they didn't have to do much leading of him. And the two priests fell asleep in the cart. Well, all of a sudden, the horse stopped so suddenly that it jolted them awake. And in front of them stood a hooded figure with a fiddle and a bow. Now, they couldn't see his face, but they could hear his voice. And he said, stop, Father. I'll lead you to the dying man, if you'll do me one favor when we get there. So the priest, not wanting to argue with somebody that could possibly be from another place, followed on. And the man began to play the most beautiful music, so beautiful and so sad that it would bring tears from your teeth. So on they went until they arrived at the gate of where the cottage was. The fiddle player stood aside, and the cart and the horse began to move in. But just before they disappeared up the driveway, the fiddler stood in front of them and said, Father, there's one thing I want you to do. You've given the last rites to that dying man up in that cottage. You ask him a question for me. You ask him what the good people have to do to get into heaven on the day of judgment. So the priest said, what? He says, it's simple, Father. Ask him what will happen on the day of judgment to the good people, the others. What will happen to us? So the priest goes on ahead up to the house, and sure enough, the wife's waiting at the cottage door. She brings in the priest and the curate. All the neighbors are there. They've gathered to say their goodbyes. And into the sick room goes the priest, the old priest. And he can see that the man is definitely dying this time by the color of him. He's the color of death on him, that awful green-gray color. So he sits down beside him. He gives him the last rites. He lights the candles. He gives the holy water. He does the whole thing. And he gets up to leave and just remembers to ask the question when the wife comes into the room and says, Father, would you have a glass of whiskey with us? Now, the priest is a teetotaler, but he decides to take the glass of whiskey, not to be rude, and he downs it in one. Well, the woman refills it. So now, three glasses of whiskey later, the priest is singing in the living room with the curate and the neighbours. And the curate, seeing the priest getting a little bit out of hand, takes him by the hand. The two of them, singing, go down the driveway, get into the horse and cart, and make their way to the gate. Whereupon, the hooded figure appears again. Now, this time, the moon comes from behind a cloud, and they can see this man's face. And it is the face withered like the bark of a tree. It is yellow and green and brown, and the eyes are red. And the man says, Father, did you ask the question? And the priest goes, immediately sobered, no, son, I forgot. I'll go right back. And he hands the reins to the curate and says, here, son, you take these. I'm going back up to the cottage to speak to the dead man or the dead man. And the young curate says, me backside, you're leaving me here with him. And he runs after the priest. So the two of them go up to the cottage. They go into the cottage. The old priest makes his way straight through to the dead man, and the curate keeps the widow and the neighbours in the room. So the priest goes in, and he sits down beside the corpse, and he leans in, and he whispers, can you tell me what will happen to the good people on the day of judgment? Will they get into heaven? Whereupon the corpse sits up, the pennies fall out of the eyes, and the corpse turns and looks at the priest and says, you know, Father, I was thinking about that very same question. And the priest says, well, and he says, I'll tell you what, Father, if one drop of blood could be found in their veins on the day of judgment, the good people, the others, will see the face of God. And at that, the corpse falls back. The priest put the pennies back in his eyes, crosses his hands over him, and runs out of the house, followed by the curate. So they run down to the cart where the fiddle player stand in front of the horse, just where they left him. And they say to him, we'll have the answer for you. And the fiddle player says, well, what is it? And he says, well, I don't think you're going to be very happy with this one, but if one drop of blood could be found in their veins on the day of judgment, the good people will see the face of God. And at that, the fiddle player looks at them with a face that turns the two of them nearly to stone. So angry it is. And from his belt, he pulls a knife. He sets the fiddle down in the road, and on top of the fiddle, he sets the bow. And with the knife, he stabs his chest 12 times. And from each one of those wounds doesn't come blood, but a green liquid like stewed apple. Then he looks at the fiddle and the bow, and he jumps on top of them until they smash to smithereens. He grabs a knife and he puts it under the priest's chin, and he says, for 5,000 years, I and my people have played music on these dark roads at nights for your people of Ireland. But I tell you now, Father, no more. And you warn them that I have said no more music. And tell them to stay off the roads at night. And at that, the priest and the curate get into the cart and leave as quickly as they can. So the next day, at the service on the Sunday, the priest stands up to talk to the people. And they can see that he's shaken, and they don't understand what's going on. And the curate is pretty shaken too. And the priest tells them what happened. And from that day on, the people of Ireland would not go out at night onto the roads for fear of what the others would do to them. And until they got the cars in the late 1950s and 60s, they wouldn't be out at all on those dark roads. And when they were in the cars, they made sure they turned the radios up loud enough just in case somebody should come tapping on the window.
All right. Oh, that is so great. I'm doing a lot of talking during the show, and it's we have just a few minutes left, but I think we can get in the stuff, but thanks to me, you know, we're running out of time. It's all my fault. Can you give us a short edition of your next story, which is a Voyage of Brand? The reason I would love to hear this is because I frequently talk about how fantasies go from one world to another and then back to the original one. And I know that this story deals with that. Tell us that story.
Bran is another chieftain of Ireland. He's not a king or a high king, but he's very highly thought of because he's a great warrior. And he's also quite a shy and quiet man. There's a very big festival going on in his fort, in his dune. And at one point, Brian decided he had enough of it. He had enough of the music and the loud drinking and the talking and all the rest of it. And he made his way outside. And while he was standing in the there outside on the hill, very like what happened to Cormac, he could hear this beautiful music. And he fell asleep listening to the music. And when he woke up, he went back into the fort and he told everybody about how glorious this music was. And as he started to talk about it, in front of him appeared the most beautiful woman he'd ever seen, right there in the center of the fort. And she said to him, "Bran, gather together some of your men and come to me on the Isle of Women. And you will be loved and you will be thought of and you will find the greatest life you've ever had." So why wouldn't he? The next day, he gathered 30 of his loyal friends and they all set out in a boat and rowed across the ocean. And Manannan Mac Lir himself, the god of the sea, came to them and said to them, "You're on the right road. Keep going. You will get to the Isle of Joy and beyond that is the Isle of Women." So off they rowed and finally they came to the Isle of Joy. And sure enough, all these people were standing on the beach laughing and giggling and chatting. And one of the companions decided to go ashore and ask them, were they on the right way? But as soon as he landed, he began to laugh too and was like a fool and they could make no sense of him. They went round the island three times trying to persuade him to come on board, but he wouldn't leave it. On they went to the Isle of Women and there, sure enough, was a woman standing at the side and they were a bit more cautious. She threw out a silver ball of thread to Bran. He caught it in his hand and she pulled them ashore. And these men had a great time. They had all the lovers they wanted, all the women they wanted, all the food and festivities and music they wanted. But one of them got homesick. Nocton just did not want to stay there. He wanted back to his family. He could remember Ireland. He could remember his wife, his children. So finally, Bran agreed that they would return. And he was warned, if you go back, you will never be able to come back here again. Now, Bran, being the warrior that he was, thought that he could fight hell and fire and the water, and he'd get back if he wanted to with his men. So off they rode. And finally, they arrived off the shores of Ireland, and there in the quay were some people standing, and they called to them. And they said, "Who are you?" And he said, "I am Bran, son of Fergal." And they said, "The only Bran we know of is this Bran that we talk about in stories, and he's long dead, 500 years, set off on a voyage." And so the time had passed, 500 years. And suddenly Bran understood what the woman had told him. Nocton did not and would not believe it and got out of the boat and swam ashore. And as soon as his foot touched the island of Ireland, he faded to dust, the dust that he would have been had he been 500 years old. At that, Bran and his companions wept and the people on the shore wept because they knew these men could not return. And Bran told them their stories. He told them all that he knew of. And the people wept for him and wept for his men. And the men sadly turned their heads from Ireland and rowed out to sea, knowing that for eternity they would continue to row across the waves and hopefully, perhaps, someday find the Isle of Women again.
All right, beautiful. And I thank you because, you know, this is another example why you're excellent. I know this is a little shorter version than typical, but
yeah.
You hadn't heard the story before. You weren't losing anything. You know what I'm saying? In other words, the integrity of this story was there. And you really are a sport at doing that. And I appreciate it because these stories do take on a life of its own. You can shorten them. You can strengthen them. You can lengthen them. Mm-hmm. You can do so many things with them. But yet it doesn't necessarily change them. That is so wonderful. Now, The Bookbinder is my favorite story, period. Short. Very poignant, child-friendly masterpiece, in my opinion. And I think, for me, it's your most memorable work. I don't say that just for me. When I played it in class and for others, it is the one, Maxine, that most people remember, at least in the groups that I know. And it's another selection from your Wee Tales, and one that I think punctuates the essence of transformation. Tell us this beautiful story.
When we take our last breath, in through the window comes the bookbinder. He's a small man with round gold-rimmed glasses, and upon his body flows the alphabet of the world, the stars and the galaxies. He sits down beside us. Beside us, a table with white paper, with paper a pierce, and above it, colours. He leans in and he listens. And as we tell him our story, the pages fill with the colour and the stories of our life. He gathers them together when we finish, and he binds them. and he covers them with silk or leather or wood. And then he puts a hand to his ear and he cups it. And we listen intently. And in the distance, we can hear a child giggling. And he says to us that this book is that child's guide. And our soul sighs and leaves our body and takes the bookbinder by the hand. And together, we leave through the window.
See, this is an incredibly short story. And it is, it has one of the best first lines of any story, at least for me. You know, when we take our last breath, it's a very, very powerful line. At least I think it is, because it says everything about what we're about to hear. It unfolds so beautifully from that first line. Now, I'm going to put you in great company, Hans Christian Andersen. You probably heard the name. I'm hoping others have too, for God's sakes. But, you know, he had an ability to construct and tell stories to children about death, like Little Match Girl, one of my favorites as well. And I thought it was extraordinary the way he was able to do that. And you, like Hans Christian Andersen, has an ability to do that too. Now, I know that the Wee Tales are designed for adults. I really do know that. But yet you do, and this bookbinder is an example, it is a story that is accessible to children in understanding the concept of death. Obviously, it's told by adults, but you must think about a child when you create a story like this. That's part of your audience.
I think for me, I don't really think, I mean, this probably flies in the face of a lot of kind of what's taught about stories and writing. I rarely think about the audience. It's the story that really matters to me and the idea, and as it starts to develop. And I did write a series of stories called Chisel Tales, which is for 8 to 108-year-olds. And it's for me, it's very important because none of the names of the creatures that are like fae and different things are made up names. They're all real names because the whole book is about truth. And every story relates to a true thing. And one of the stories in it follows is about death. And it talks of how our memories keep people alive, our stories of them, which eventually will fade as generations go through. But it is our stories that keep people alive. It's a person's voice is unique. And when you tell their story, you're actually giving them voice again. And that's why we Irish believe in the Cuina. I don't know if you've ever heard of the Cuina,
yes,
Hank.
Yes, yes.
Where we make a story up or a poem up and we say it 3 times and we call the dead to us and we meet them in between the land of the living and the dead and we hold them close for one last time and tell them we love them. And then they can return to the land of the dead and us the living. So the Cuina is extremely important. So all that to me speaks of what the words can conjure up, what words can do. And that's what stories are.
And not to put too fine a point on it, but it really comes down to the fact that getting back to children for a moment, children can handle the truth. They can handle the truth.
Yes, they can.
Because that's really the fuel of so many of your stories. Tell us where we can learn more about your Wee Tales and your Chisel Stories, how we can reach out to you if interested.
If interested in me at all, I mean, interested in what I do. I mean,
I'm going to have it all on Facebook, all of your contact information. I'm going to put it there.
Yes, yeah, surely.
Can contact your website, but is there any other thing you want to share with us
I'd like, you know, yeah, contact me by email is probably the best way. Okay. I will respond to that mostly. Yes, Ellensburg Community Radio here in Ellensburg in Washington. I recorded a novel I wrote about Belfast 20 odd years ago, but decided to record it and they liked it. And we had it on Ellensburg Community Radio, which can be reached, and on that is Telling Tales, and I'll be doing probably Chisel. I'm hoping to.
You could send me if you could send me that link. Could you send me that link?
I will.
That would be great.
I will.
Thank you.
I certainly will, Hank. I'd be delighted to. But yes, people can reach out to me anytime. I'm very open to speaking and talking with people. I've written Feathered Tales as well, which is a series of adult, if you like, fairy tales. Again, always dealing with truth, and I think as you say, children roll with the truth, and we as adults, and that's part of the journey and we have to do is connect back with that essential stillness and truth within us. And yes, we can do that through stories.
Well, Maxine, you know, we've had several Irish tellers on this program and they are always a hit, but in my opinion, you always hit a home run. All of these years knowing you and enjoying your stories have treated us to the landscapes of Ireland, complete with the legends that form them. You demonstrate what Irish poet Seamus Heaney, I know it's pronounced correctly, I looked it up, claimed, and that is if you have words, you'll like this one, if you have words, there's always a chance that you'll find your way. Makes sense, right? I did pronounce that correctly, right?
Correct, Seamus. You did. And okay, to be honest, but yeah, and for me, it's like with words, whenever someone can, if something is sitting like a rock within you and you allow it to fall out of your mouth, it's almost like at that point you've reduced it to what it needs to be for you to accept it. I'm not saying that it will disappear. I've often talked like this with people with grief. I'm not saying that it's going to disappear, but it will become a lesser part of you. And it should still be an essential part of you because we should not forget. But it will become something, once you form the words for it, you're managing it. You're beginning to deal with it and accept it.
Well, thank you for your astonishing skill and appreciated friendship. And let's do this again before another 7 years go by.
Certainly.
Better so, right? We better.
Thank
all right.
You.
KPFT is seeking programming of all kinds for our new streaming channel. From music to talk, we want it all. Whether you're a seasoned veteran or a novice, we'd love to hear your big idea. If you're a local podcaster or know one, here's a chance to move from digital to FM. KPFT's web streaming channel replicates on our FM channel, so your idea needs to adhere to language and other policies mandated by the FCC. These projects also need to be non-commercial in nature. Interested? Just visit kpft.org and click on the Propose a Show tab towards the bottom of our front page. Multilingual programming is also welcome. Again, just visit kpft.org for details. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lazarus, and this is Climate Connections. When people talk about solutions to global warming, they often focus on large-scale efforts that can cut a lot of carbon pollution. But sometimes those big ideas have drawbacks. For example, large-scale tree planting can help reduce climate change, but it might also reduce the amount of available food.
If you're planting trees on a really wide scale, you're potentially pushing out places where people are already producing food.
Pamela McAwee of Rutgers University evaluated 40 different land management and food production strategies that can reduce carbon pollution. Her goal was to identify solutions that offer climate benefits with fewer drawbacks.
We found some things that don't sound particularly sexy. They don't sound like they're the flavor of the month, but they can be really important and they don't get us significant trade-offs and risk.
For example, strategies such as reducing soil erosion, improving grazing land management, and growing trees alongside traditional crops can help keep more carbon in the soil. Some strategies can also bring other benefits, such as creating habitat for pollinators. McAwee hopes that her research helps policymakers develop ambitious climate strategies with fewer unwanted consequences. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
When you purchase the latest TV, tablet, or smartphone, don't forget to do the right thing with your old ones. Recycle them. The Consumer Technology Association and its members are making recycling your old devices as easy as buying new ones. Just go to greenergadgets.org, type in your zip code, and you'll instantly find the recycling location closest to your home. You'll also find recycling tips, like asking the store where you buy your new TV if they'll haul away your old one. Don't let your old tech tools clog your local landfill. Just visit greenergadgets.org. KPFT Houston. Family Houston is a nonprofit organization that provides mental health counseling for children in the greater Houston area. Family Houston's counseling program helps children manage negative feelings before they interfere with school or lead to risky behaviors. Appointments can be made in English or Spanish by calling 713-861-4849. For more information, email media at